to the fourth case of the day, Ryder Truck Rental versus the NLRB.
The whole group is there. Clean water.
Law school?
Mm-hmm.
Law school?
They look older.
Mr. McNeil.
May it please the court, my name is Andrew McNeil. I'm counsel of record for the petitioner cross-respondent, Ryder Truck Rental, Inc. And at counsel table with me is Frank Lopez, who is an in-house counsel for Ryder. The question presented in the briefs in this case are whether there is substantial evidence in the record to support the determination that Ryder had violated Sections 8A1 and 8A3 of the National Labor Relations Act in discharging Tim Bowman and Alan Felcher. Restating those questions less generically, the questions are whether the board can sit as a super personnel department and provide its own interpretation of company policies without any evidence in the record to support that interpretation of the policy, whether the board can impute knowledge of union activity from Ryder generally to a decision maker specifically without any evidence to support that finding, to support the finding that the decision maker was aware of the discharged employee's union activity, and finally, whether an employee's five violations of the same safety policy in less than 12 months become irrelevant because the union has filed a petition for an election such that Ryder cannot terminate that employee following his sixth violation of that same safety rule. The two employees at issue are Tim Bowman and Alan Felcher. I want to address Tim Bowman first. The facts relevant to his discharge are at the night in question, Mr. Bowman had been assigned to perform a preventative maintenance on a truck, a Dixon fish truck that had a refrigerated unit to keep fish frozen. Now, this preventative maintenance required him to change the oil filter. And as part of that process, he was required to restart the engine after he had changed the filter. Now, he admitted that he did not restart the engine after he changed the filter. But he also admitted that he checked off on this preventative maintenance form that he had in fact restarted the engine. Now, these PM forms, as they're referred to, are required to be maintained by the Department of Transportation. 49 CFR 396.3 requires motor carriers to systematically inspect, repair, and maintain all motor vehicles subject to its control or to make sure that those events occur. And that same regulation requires that the motor carrier keep a record of all inspections. And 49 U.S.C. section 14907 creates a civil liability of up to $5,000 for falsifying a report.
And are there any other cases in which Ryder terminated an employee like it did Bowman for falsely filling out a preventative maintenance form on the first offense?
There are no other cases at the Indianapolis Customer Business Unit where there is evidence that an employee had falsified preventative maintenance form, that had knowingly falsified that form.
Mr. McGill, what are we going to do with the ALJ who expressly discredits the testimony of Buckley and Cicini?
The ALJ drew into question the testimony of Buckley and Cicini concerning Felcher.
He questioned whether about Bowman's discharge for falsification.
Right. Well, there were questions raised at the trial of whether Buckley or Cicini would concur or recommend discharge under these circumstances. Neither one of them were involved or consulted in the discharge decision. So the fact that the ALJ is discrediting their testimony really has no effect on the analysis of Bowman's discharge. What had happened was the ALJ concluded that Ryder pointed to the wrong policy. It had its corporate conduct guidelines that included, as a violation of those guidelines, submitting a false report to operational management. And the testimony was that is exactly what a preventative maintenance form is. It is an operational, it's a report submitted to operational management. Now, the board, in its decision, and general counsel picks up on this, points to another policy that's in the employee handbook that says falsification of information is prohibited, and specifically referencing falsification of information on employment applications. Further, the ALJ and the board and the general counsel have all argued that the corporate conduct guidelines are more specifically focused to conduct to stealing and conduct that allows the employee to gain personally as a result of the misconduct. But a review of that policy, which is set forth in the record as GC7 at our appendix site, page 217, review of that demonstrates that it's broader than that, because it also includes misuse of the company email, misuse of the company computer systems, and that is not something that involves personal gain to the employee. So the fact that Ryder relied on its corporate conduct guidelines and not this other provision in the employee handbook really is the board sitting as a super personnel department making its own determinations of Ryder policy without any evidence in the record to support that interpretation.
Well, with respect to Bowman, you said, you know, there was no other instance where somebody submitted a false statement on a preventative maintenance form, but didn't the board find that Ryder manager encouraged falsification of company documents, including times in which he ordered Bowman to falsify repair records so they could be billed to the customer rather than Ryder?
There was testimony from Bowman that Supervisor Wolke had given that directive. But
right.
And
the board so found.
Right.
They believe that.
Right, they did. But there is also no evidence in the record to support the finding that Dave Tonegas, who was the decision maker concerning Tim Bowman's employment, had any awareness or knowledge at all of Wolke's alleged conduct, or the conduct that had been found as attributed to Wolke here. So from Tonegas's point of view, when he learned that Tim Bowman had falsified, knowingly and admittedly falsified, this document required to be maintained by the Department of Transportation, and being fully aware of Ryder's corporate conduct guidelines, which, not incidentally, Bowman signed off on during his employment, he made the determination that that policy applied and that Bowman's employment had to come to an end as a result of submitting that false report to operational management. This is not unlike the situation in the Sears Roebuck case that was recently decided by this court about a year ago, in which you had continuing misconduct or you had knowingly false warranty repair reports being submitted to management, and intervening there was a union campaign, not unlike here, where this court held that there was insufficient evidence to support a finding that a violation had occurred.
But in that instance, we weren't talking about a supervisor who was deemed not credible with respect to parts of his testimony. Isn't that right? So that gets back to what Judge Flom raised, you know, how do we deal with that particular finding? So that's something different than in that case.
But the discrete issue here that is not discredited by the administrative law judge, and in fact is based on undisputed and admitted testimony, Bowman falsified the report. You have a consumer, or you have a corporate conduct guideline that makes it a violation of that guideline subject to termination for submitting that false report. You have the Department of Transportation regulations on the issue, and you have Tonegas making the determination.
Yeah, but that case you were relying on, there were multiple violations. Here we're talking about one.
But in the Sears case, there was not a government regulation that created a civil liability on the part of the employer for falsification of the warranty repair. That was an instance where the employee benefited personally and the company was negatively impacted because the work hadn't been done. Here, there's a government regulation and a statute that makes it a civil liability of up to $5,000. So I think, given the gravity of Bowman's offense, discharge was warranted. So ultimately, the board erred in concluding that Ryder had failed to satisfy its national transportation burden of demonstrating that it would have taken the same action relative to Bowman regardless of the union activity. Any other finding creates, or at least supports, the right to lie on the part of an employee who happens to be a union supporter. So because of the lack of substantial evidence in the record, Ryder asked that the board's order as it relates to Bowman not be enforced. Concerning Alan Felcher, he was terminated for violation of Ryder's safety policy on safety glasses. Safety glasses are mandatory for everyone working in or entering all areas of the shop, fuel island, or wherever maintenance work is being performed.
But here we have a situation where Ryder gave Felcher an evaluation with, which noted his improvement in safety, gave him a dollar raise, and then terminated him for safety violations the next day.
Right.
Isn't that rather
that's exactly what happened.
Problematic for you.
Well, let's put that into the context. The context is, starting in February of 2000, on the 2nd and 3rd of February of 2000, Felcher receives his first and second warning for failing to wear his safety glasses. And Wolke, the supervisor, is the one who issued that warning, wrote on that warning that the employee needs to be reminded every day to wear his safety glasses. About 2 weeks later, he receives his evaluation for the prior year. And in that evaluation, he receives a very low mark for safety, in fact, the lowest mark available for safety. Then in May of 2000, Felcher is suspended for 3 days as a result of failing again to wear his safety glasses and also for an attendance violation. It's stated in that suspension that the next violation of the policy will result in Felcher's termination. Then Felcher himself testified that between May 2000 suspension and September of 2000, he had been warned again verbally by Wolke and also by Tonegas to put his, or at least directed to put his safety glasses on. Then you have the union petition in December of 2000. The union pulls the petition in January of 2000. Then Felcher again is caught without his safety glasses on February 11th of 2000 and receives his evaluation later that same day. Now, the February 11th occurrence, Felcher is working on a truck that he has 20 minutes to get out and the driver is waiting. And the testimony was a screw fell out of his glasses and they broke. So instead of going to get a replacement pair of glasses, he continues working on the truck. But as soon as he sees Wolke walk into the shop floor, he immediately goes to his toolbox and gets another pair of glasses and puts them on, goes back and finishes his work. Then after that, asks Wolke for his evaluation, which is an assessment of his performance from for 2000, coming into January of 2001. And on that evaluation, it's noted that he had improved in his proclivities for wearing his safety glasses. He, in fact, received a higher rating instead of receiving the lowest possible rating in that area. So he went from someone who didn't wear his glasses hardly at all and had to be reminded every day to someone who had been suspended and given a final notice, then receives his evaluation. The critical point is Tonegas was not aware of Felcher's union activity. In fact, Felcher testified that he never told Tonegas that he was a supporter of the union. There was testimony that other managers knew. The board has imputed that testimony to Tonegas without any support in the record, without any suggestion that those managers actually communicated to Tonegas Felcher's support of the union.
And so the board, you're saying, can't make a credibility determination and disbelieve someone on, you know, what they're saying. Like he's saying he didn't have any knowledge. They don't have the power to make that assessment.
The board can make a credibility determination, but they do not have the power to assume the opposite of what has been testified to is true. And that's what they did here without evidence to support that conclusion. Finally, where we're left is we have a discharge that's alleged to have been motivated by union activity. That's really the culmination of the final suspension or the final notice in the suspension paper from May of 2000. There was not another employee identified by either party who was subject to the same final notice, final warning status. We have an admitted violation of the policy. Ryder executed the threat in the final warning letter, terminated Felcher's employment. We request that that portion of the board's order not be enforced, and I reserve the remaining time for rebuttal.
Right, thank you, Mr. McNeil. Mr. Young.
May it please the court. The question of the knowledge element of the board's case with respect to Felcher, I don't believe that the company seriously contests the affirmative case of the board either, and certainly not with respect to Mr. Bullman, and only with regard to the knowledge element with respect to Mr. Felcher. the company's case really comes down to the credibility of Tonegas, who the ALJ found to be not to be a credible witness. Tonegas, after all, contradicted his own pre-hearing affidavit in this case when he claimed that the company never sought to threaten the employees with bargaining from scratch. Tonegas was also involved in a number of the unfair labor practices that bears pointing out. So the ALJ had ample reasons for viewing his testimony with a great deal of skepticism. In addition, I would point out, with respect to Felsher, and Bultman, that the ALJ could reasonably conclude that the incidents relied on to discharge the two employees were not the real reasons for the discharge, but were based on the union activity of Felsher, for instance. That the fact that he had recently raised at the end of January the whole issue of challenging the company on reneging on that vacation plan, and that he planned to raise that in the safety meeting. The company, of course, claims that Tonegas had no knowledge of that, but certainly the board could infer knowledge from the circumstances in this case. I would point out in particular that Tonegas was at the heart of that violation. He was the one who delayed posting the memorandum that the company had informed him to post immediately. He delayed posting it until after the petition for the election had been withdrawn and was no longer at issue. So, and it's clear, as the board pointed out, that the company had informants in the bargaining unit which were keeping management well informed of the activities of employees. They knew of the union activity even before the petition was ever filed. So the board had ample evidence in this case to infer company knowledge of Felsher's threatened challenge to the reneging on the vacation policy.
Well, one of counsel's big arguments is that Felsher had been repeatedly reprimanded and suspended for not wearing those goggles. Wasn't the termination justified when he continued not to wear them?
He was warned once, Your Honor, and that was in given that written warning once, and that was in May, he was given two verbal warnings, admittedly, after that. But the company never pressed that until after the advent of the union activity, until after the last incident on February 12th. I would disagree with company counsel that there was no claim made that no one had ever received a final warning. I believe the record will show that Buckley testified that another person had been given a final warning, but the company had no documentation. Again, it comes back to the credibility of the company's witnesses. They never produced documentation of anything. They tried to claim that they had a strict policy of enforcing safety glass infractions, but they could not substantiate that. Certainly not through the credibility of those witnesses, and they provided no documentary support for that. And if the board went on to analyze, however, even if you took the company's, in particular Tonegas' testimony at face value, that he would have discharged a person for three infractions, regardless of union activity. It begs the question, then, why didn't he do it before the advent of the union activity itself? Because, according to the record, there were three infractions, according to Tonicus, after there were two more after the final warning was given in May. So there is no credible basis for the company waiting until February 11th to discharge Felscher if the reason was divorced from the union activity itself. Turning to employee Bullman, in that case, the company does concede that the board made out an affirmative case of union that the discharge was motivated by union activity. So the only question was whether the company proved its defense that it would have discharged Bullman even in the absence of that activity. And again, as Judge Williams pointed out, the company can point to no other case where an employee was discharged for a single instance of filing a false preventive maintenance form. The board, however, noted that the policy that the company cites, first of all, it doesn't even mandate a discharge, and second, that whatever the violation that the company had options here about what to charge Bullman with. It could have charged him with a different violation, something like falsification of an application, where the policy expressly provided that the employee should be warned. The fact that the company didn't do that and reached for what it deemed more serious policy, again, suggests the pretextual nature of the company's conduct. I would disagree with Mr. McNeil's statement that that there was any safety implication in the mechanical infraction that Mr. Bullman committed. This, after all, involved the refrigeration unit of the truck. It may have been some threat to the customer product in this case, but there's no reason to believe that it was a threat to the operational safety of the truck.
Well, could discipline be appropriate even in the latter case, Mr. Young?
I'm sorry, Your
Honor? Would discipline still be appropriate in the latter case? I mean, if there was a threat to the product of the customer? I'm not ranking.
I believe the pretextual nature of the company's claim would be equally as patent. So, and I would point out that unless there are other questions, the board would submit its case.
All right. Thank you. Mr. McNeil.
Thank you. Just briefly, there is issues with credibility, but the evidence that Whit Ryder is relying on in this appeal and for this argument is really the undisputed testimony even of the board's witnesses, Felscher and Bullman, and their admitted violations of company policy. Concerning the union informants within the company ranks, if you recall, Chairman Batista dissented from the board's decision on the issue of whether reporting harassment or making requests that reports of harassment of union affiliates be put in writing. That was pre-petition, so of course Ryder had information because employees had felt harassed by Mr. Bowman. Tonegas was unaware of Mr. Felscher's status of being on a last and final warning until February 12th of 2000, when in fact he reviewed Mr. Felscher's file. So it was not until that time that Tonegas had all of the information he needed, knowing that Mr. Felscher was not internalizing the importance of wearing these safety glasses. that it was finally determined that his employment would come to an end. Concerning the issue of Mr. Felcher wanting to raise Ryder's retraction of certain vacation policies and how he was going to raise that at a safety meeting, that's not suggestive of union activity, nor is there any evidence in the record that supports that Felcher made that statement to anyone other than some of his hourly coworkers. There's no indication other than this unsupported speculation by the board that information traveled from the rank and file hourly workers to the management personnel. And I see that my time is up. We thank you. And
thank you, Mr. McNeil. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.